This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to hear about the Glock and how this high-capacity Austrian-made pistol, which was introduced in the 80s, became the preferred gun for America's cops and most law enforcement officials. Our first guest, Paul Barrett, is the author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Barrett writes about what set the Glock apart from other pistols and how it was marketed to cops, gun enthusiasts, and Hollywood. Glock's manufacturer even managed to make a profit from the 10-year ban on assault weapons. Barrett's an assistant managing editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. He spoke with Terry last week.
Paul Barrett, welcome to Fresh Air. So when the Glock was first manufactured, and this is, what, 1982? What
right.
made it different from other guns?
Well, Gaston Glock, the Austrian curtain rod maker who invented the Glock, started with a genius approach, which is to say he started from scratch, a blank piece of paper, and he asked gun experts what would be the ideal firearm for the modern era. And they said a gun with much larger ammunition capacity, a gun that is much more durable and reliable. And so that prompted him to think about injection molded plastic rather than the traditional materials of blued steel and walnut grips. The gun should be easy to fire, and the gun should be easy to learn how to use. It shouldn't have complicated safety mechanisms. He integrated all of these elements into the Glock, and that's how he won his original contract with the Austrian Army.
So because it was largely made out of plastic and not steel, it was lighter to carry, which was an advantage.
Correct.
And it wasn't going to rust.
Right.
And it didn't have a safety lock.
It doesn't have an external safety of the traditional sort that a semi-automatic pistol will have. It also doesn't have a so-called decocking mechanism, which some guns, like, for example, the Beretta that we mentioned earlier, has. These features make it more similar to a traditional revolver in that you just pull it out, you point it, and you pull the trigger, and it's ready to go. On the other side, however, gun skeptics have pointed out that this makes the Glock more prone to accidents. And if someone is not trained to use the gun, if someone, for example, lets their finger linger on the trigger, that is true. It is easier to fire the Glock than it is some other guns. So the safety issue has two sides to it.
And how many rounds did the Glock 17, mm-hmm. the first Glock, hold?
Yeah, coincidentally, it holds 17 rounds in its magazine. I say coincidentally because most people think that's why it's called the Glock 17. Not so. Gaston Glock was a little bit eccentric in naming his guns, called his first basic pistol the 17 because it was his 17th patent, and he was very, very proud of that. So that still remains the basic Glock model, but you can have up to a 33-round magazine in a Glock, so it can have quite a bit of capacity.
So an Austrian named Gaston Glock, who isn't even in the gun business, decides to
right.
manufacture a gun from scratch to suit what the Austrian army needs, comes up with a Glock 17. It works really well. And mm-hmm. then U.S. law enforcement agencies start buying it, in part because the invention of the Glock coincides with a lot of American cops feeling outgunned by gangs and drug lords. So how does he start getting a foothold in the American law enforcement world?
Well, the first big element is the one you very correctly identified, which is he had just perfect timing. Gaston Glock was ready to come to the United States in 1986, 1987, and at precisely that time, particularly in many big cities, crack cocaine was creating a whole lot of violence on the street, particularly gun violence, and cops just felt that they were at a disadvantage. So timing was crucial. Second thing was Glock himself is not really much of a salesman, but he was smart enough to hire a genius salesman in the United States, a transplanted Austrian who had been selling weapons to police departments around the country for many years. And this man, Carl Walter, was really something of a guru in figuring out how to appeal to the police, whether that meant offering them extremely attractive financial terms or it meant hosting police procurement officers at Atlanta's notorious Gold Club, the most famous strip club in town. This was a guy who could make a deal with anybody and figure out how to sell the Glock.
Well, this guy, the salesman, is really interesting in and of himself. His name's Carl Walter. And what was he doing? How was he selling guns before the Glock?
He was kind of a freelance representative of European gun companies, mostly very specialized companies that sold military-style weapons to American police departments. And he traveled around the country in a customized RV that was basically a traveling gun shop made up with all kinds of display cases. And he would pull up to a police department and they'd come in and look at his sniper rifles and his semi-automatics and his fully automatic guns. And he would sell them. These were very high-margin items. And this gave him a lot of entree to these same police departments when he came back and said, I've got a new product. This is not a fancy product. This is a basic product. This is going to be your new basic handgun. And he had a lot of credibility with these departments. And again, he was a very, very persuasive guy, charming guy. And, he was amenable to taking people out to expensive dinners, taking them out to see adult entertainment. Whatever it took, Carl Walter got the job done.
So one of the ways that Carl Walter wanted to sell the Glock in America was just get some publicity for it.
Mm-hmm.
So he decides, Soldier of Fortune magazine, let's try to get them to write an article. And he succeeds,
right.
And the article is titled Plastic Perfection. Just a reminder,
right.
That the Glock is made primarily out of plastic. So that's why,
right.
it was headlined Plastic Perfection. So how helpful was this Soldier of Fortune article in actually publicizing the Glock?
Well, this was crucial because the article was written by a very credible gun writer named Peter Kokalis, who was well-known in gun circles, both law enforcement and civilian. And there was going inevitably to be a lot of skepticism about the Glock because it was made from plastic. And if you roll time back to the 70s and 80s, that was a period when we were still saying, oh, something's made of plastic, it's cheap, it's made in Taiwan. There was still a lot of skepticism about the transfer over to industrial-strength plastic for all kinds of products. And Kokalis addressed that issue head on, and he said, I was skeptical of it too. I went over to Austria. I tried this gun. People, you've got to try it too. And this was a huge door opener for Glock. And the focus on plastic soon developed into a controversy that was also a selling point because the reaction from gun control advocates was that because the Glock is plastic, it'll become a terrorist tool. You'll be able to sneak it into airports past the security devices.
Past the metal detectors.
Exactly. And this created a genuine controversy. I'm talking about congressional hearings. Jack Anderson, the muckraking columnist of his day in the 80s, writing column after column, syndicated in newspapers all across the country. Suddenly people were talking about the Glock before there were even more than a handful of the guns in this country. This kind of attention is priceless. As Carl Walter said to me, I could not have paid $50 million, $100 million for that kind of notoriety. And then it turned out that the allegations weren't true, that in fact you could see a Glock on an airport x-ray machine because a big piece of industrial strength plastic shaped like a gun looks just like a gun on the monitor. Secondly, if you have a magnetometer, the gun has an all-metal slide, a solid steel slide. That's the rectangular piece on top of a pistol that moves back and forth as it fires. And also the bullets, of course, are metal. So if someone's going to actually shoot a gun, they need bullets. And the whole controversy evaporated. Gun control advocates really were embarrassed by the whole thing. And Glock was left with all of this attention. It was quite an extraordinary episode.
So we were talking about how the salesman, Carl Walter, introduced, kind of sold the Glock to America. And the Glock was made in Austria. The Austrian army had been using it, but it was new to America in the 80s. So one of the things that Carl Walter does to help sell the gun to law enforcement agencies is to give police departments really big discounts on their purchases of the Glock. How did that work? Why did he do it?
Right. Walter's savvy was crucial to Glock breaking into the American market. He gave Gaston Glock, his employer, several important pieces of advice. First of all, the gun is manufactured very efficiently at the factory. The factory was built brand new to make this gun. So Glock has very, very high profit margins. Gaston Glock was inclined to sell it at a relatively low price, retail price in this country, and Carl Walter said, no, we're going to set the retail price relatively high. We don't want people to think this is a junk gun. We want them to think that this is a high-quality gun, and the price will indicate that. But then when he went to the police departments, he said, look, I'll give you a huge discount from the recommended retail price. Basically, you tell me what you can pay. You give me your old guns as trade-ins, and I'll outfit you with with new Glocks. And this was smart because the point was not to make an early profit on the police departments. The point was to get the police departments to adopt the gun, and that would give the gun credibility in the much larger, much more lucrative civilian market where you can charge full price and get your full profit margin. So this was Walter's very, very crafty strategy.
One of the places that Walter wanted to sell the Glock was to the New York Police Department, but there was a ban against the Glock in New York. Was that in New York City or the whole state?
New York City, where the New York Police Department controls gun regulation. And this was an extraordinary situation because the police department did not ban a category of guns. It didn't say large capacity guns. It said Glock. This brand can't come into this city. Neither the cops nor civilians may own it. And so
why?
In 86, 80,
why did they single out the Glock?
This was related to this plastic pistol controversy, the idea that the Glock was going to become the hijacker's special, that only a diabolical criminal would want this mysterious plastic gun that could hold so many rounds. In New York, this was taken to the extreme of a flat-out ban. But this ban only lasted until 1988, when there was a real news scoop by the Associated Press that was then picked up and trumpeted by the New York Post. It turned out that while everyone in the city was banned from having the Glock, the top cop in the city, the police commissioner himself, was carrying a Glock under his suit coat. And obviously this was a terribly embarrassing situation for the police department. Suddenly the Glock was no longer a threat to the populace. The ban was dropped, and within a short period of time, the New York Police Department was beginning to buy Glocks itself. And within a few years, you had the largest police department in the country, the police department that's portrayed most often on television, carrying Glocks. And this was a huge breakthrough for Carl Walter, for Gaston Glock, and for the Glock pistol. By 1994, a bill was passed. This is what we remember as the Assault Weapons Bill, and was signed into law by President Clinton and became effective in 1994. And it had a variety of restrictions. One of them was limiting the ammunition capacity for pistol magazines to 10 rounds. This was seen at the time as a terrible blow to Glock. But little did most observers understand, but it actually was once more a tremendous counterintuitive advantage for Glock. Why? Because Glock had seen this bill coming for years and had been running the factory nonstop, three shifts a day, 7 days a week, building up the large capacity firearms and the large capacity magazines, so that when the law was enacted, and allowed for basically a loophole that grandfathered in pre-existing equipment before the ban went into effect, Glock had this huge stockpile of the very equipment that many gun owners wanted to get because it was banned, and the value of that equipment skyrocketed, so that a large capacity magazine that might have cost $19 at retail in 1993 by 1995 was selling for $50. Another profit bonanza for Glock.
And there's another incredibly clever, you could say devious, way that Glock got around the ban by with police departments. Why don't you describe what it did with police departments?
Absolutely. Glock became famous for its trade-in policies. This began before the ban, but it was made all the more lucrative by the ban. So Glock would first, in the 80s or early 90s, persuade a police department to trade in its Smith & Wesson revolvers for the Glock 17. Then Glock would come back just a couple of years later like a crafty auto salesman and say, well, you really ought to trade up. Now we've got the Glock 40 caliber, which is a larger caliber, and that has more stopping power, and we're going to give you just a great deal. It's going to cost you almost nothing to get brand new guns. All you got to do is give us your old guns. And police departments, which were eager to save money, were quite happy to do this. Well, the reason Glock could make such advantageous deals from the police department's perspective was that those pre-ban, large-capacity, former police guns were worth a fortune on the used gun market, particularly once such guns had been banned. So Glock now had what, in some ways you could see as kind of contraband, but that had been grandfathered in under the law, and that they were able to resell on the secondary market for huge profits. This process of always finding the folds in the law, finding the exceptions, finding the ways to kind of get around the intent of efforts to restrict the Glock became a trademark for the company. And right from the start, it helped the company, and it continued on through its entire history.
So in terms of unintended consequences, it meant that police departments and trading in their old Glocks were inadvertently contributing to having more high-capacity weapons on the streets because those guns would be sold to people who would use who would carry them on the streets.
Absolutely. And that fact, the fact that the police departments were implicated in the proliferation of handguns all across the country, would come back to haunt the municipalities for which those police departments worked later in the decade, when those municipalities tried to sue the gun industry on the theory that the gun industry was irresponsibly flooding the streets with guns that could be put to no useful or lawful purpose. Well, when those lawsuits were launched against Glock and its rival manufacturers, Glock's executives would pop up on television and say, who are you accusing of putting guns on the street? We've done business with the very city, the police department in this city, that's now suing us. It's their guns that are on the street. So this really undercut those lawsuits. And again, one more example of Glock's kind of counterpunching approach that at every turn was such an advantage to the company in commercial terms.
So, you know, there was an assault weapons ban that President Clinton signed in 1994 that outlawed high-capacity weapons. So, you know, the 17-round Glock was illegal under that law. 10 years after the assault weapons ban was enacted, it expired. It expired in 2004, and
correct,
Congress did not renew it, which is why Jared Loughner was able to buy the high-capacity magazine gun that he used in Tucson in the shooting that injured Gabrielle Giffords, who just resigned her position in Congress. It said that
you've
she
got
needed
that
to
exactly
just focus
right
on her recovery. So you are very skeptical that Democrats will be able to pass any gun control legislation if they haven't passed it in the wake of that Tucson shooting.
Yes. And it's not just in the wake of the Tucson shooting. I mean, you can go all the way back to the terrible events at Columbine, the school shootings that captured so much attention back in 98, 99. No new federal gun control legislation was passed in the wake of those school shootings, which in some ways is even more remarkable than the fact that in the wake of Virginia Tech and in the wake of Tucson, we have similarly seen no new efforts to restrict the legal sale or ownership of guns. In fact, it's quite to the contrary. Over that period of time, gun laws in the United States are getting looser, not tighter. It is easier to carry a gun in many states. It is easier to get gun permits. And we've now had a Democratic president for three-plus years. And he's said barely a word about gun control one way or the other. So I think it's very fair to say that for a variety of reasons, and we can talk about those if you wish, the gun control debate has really been won for the moment by the NRA and by the industry that it cooperates with and by those people who are in favor of widespread civilian ownership of guns.
One thing you mentioned in your reporting is that, you know, Gabrielle Giffords used to carry a Glock, and she hasn't, at least as of yet, spoken in support of gun control.
That is correct. Since the shooting, she has remained silent on that issue. It's also correct that she owned not just a Glock, but she owned the precise model that that the killer in Tucson used, the Glock 19. And I think the fact that someone like Gabrielle Giffords, who for other purposes, you wouldn't necessarily think of as, you know, particularly being a gun owner or a gun aficionado, does own a gun, is very telling. We have had a transition in this country where I think gun rights are getting more respect than they used to get. The United States Supreme Court has issued several important rulings in the last several years supporting gun rights, knocking down municipal gun control laws in Chicago and in New York. And all of this, I think, traces back to one very crucial development, which is indisputably good news. And that's this. While crime rates were rising from the early 1960s through the early 1990s, adding a lot of punch and credibility to the argument that more guns means more crime, and providing a very strong argument, at least on the surface, to gun control proponents that we're a nation in the grip of rising violent crime. Since 1993, crime rates in the United States have been going down. They went down dramatically across the 1990s and have continued to fall into the 2000s. Meanwhile, we don't have fewer guns in the United States. We have, of course, more guns because every year millions are produced and sold. So the reality of falling crime rates has taken a lot of the air out of the gun control movement. And this is a very fascinating development, which I think liberals, Democrats, and people who are professional gun control advocates have not really come to grips with. If there's an argument about guns, it really has to shift. It has to be adjusted to take into account the fact that crime levels in a place like New York are now back to where they were in the late 1950s. I mean, New York is a much safer city. That's not because there are fewer guns on the street. Our gun laws haven't changed. So people need to think about these things in a different light, whatever your partisan view is.
Well, Paul Barrett, thank you so much for talking with us.
You bet. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Paul Barrett is the author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. They didn't have many big hits, and in the beginning, when it would have made a difference, they didn't even make videos. In the 1980s, when post-punk extravagance was the name of the game, they dared to call themselves the Smiths, as if to pretend they were just an ordinary bunch of guys. And yet they were one of the defining groups of their era. With the release of their complete works, rock historian Ed Ward has the occasion to look back and try and figure out what made them so important. And if you have 5 seconds to spare, then I'll tell you the story of my life. 16, clumsy and shy, I went to London and died. I booked myself in at the Y, WCA. I said, I like it here, can I stay? I like it here, can I stay? Do you have a vacancy for a back scrubber?
When Stephen Patrick Morrissey was 13, he was watching the Old Grey Whistle Test, a BBC rock television show, when the New York Dolls came on. Later he said that it was my first real emotional experience. It was hardly his last. Growing up awkward, tall, and shy in suburban Manchester, he was the archetypal kid who didn't fit in, writing poetry and letters to the British rock press, disagreeing articulately with their critics. Years before, Manchester had lost out to Liverpool as Britain's provincial rock capital, but with the arrival of punk, it snatched the crown back. Morrissey joined a punk band called the Nosebleeds briefly, but he had other ideas. In May 1982, he read that a writer for Record Mirror named Johnny Marr, a guitarist who'd been in a couple of bands, was looking for a lyricist. The two met and hit it off immediately. And a year later, they'd put together a band, had a couple of gigs, been signed to London's Rough Trade Records, and started releasing singles. It took a couple of them, but they eventually had a hit of sorts. All men have secrets and here is mine, so let it be known. For we have been through hell and high tide, I think I can rely on you. And yet you start to recoil, heavy words are so lightly thrown. But still I leap in front of a flying bullet for you. So our difference does it make? This wasn't pop music as we knew it by any means, although a superficially similar band, R.E.M., was operating in the United States, an odd vocalist matched with a guitarist who could seemingly do anything. Unlike Michael Stipe, though, Morrissey didn't cloak his lyrics in ambiguity. The rain falls hard on a humdrum town. This town has dragged you down. Oh, the rain falls hard on a humdrum town. This town has dragged you down. Morrissey claimed to be celibate, although the British pop press was skeptical. The slowly increasing number of fans didn't care, though. Some of them were drawn to the confessional songwriting, some to the guitar sounds. For instance, on the B-side of William It Was Really Nothing was this gem.
I'm the sun and the air. All the shyness that is criminally vulgar. I am the sun and air. But nothing in particular. Shut your mouth, how can you say? I go about things the wrong way. I am human and I need to be loved, just like everybody else does.
The Smiths were also lucky to have a rhythm section like bassist Andy Rourke and drummer Mike Joyce, who seemed to navigate the odd twists and turns of Johnny Marr's melodies with ease. The Smiths were also masters of marketing. Each of their singles and albums had, on the cover, an icon of filmdom, his or her photograph, manipulated by Morrissey and Rough Trade's art director Joe Slee. Terrence Stamp, Elvis Presley, Shelagh Delaney, and James Dean were among the cover boys and girls who gave a new Smiths release a distinctive look. And it was a good thing that there was a distinctive look, because after their second album, Meat Is Murder, took aim at some social issues, it became clear that Marr's melodies were pretty similar and that Morrissey's great subject was himself, take it or leave it. What happened next was complicated. The band slowly gained momentum with the fans, at least in Britain. Their third album, The Queen Is Dead, is probably the high point of the band's career, released in June 1986 after a long and unexplained delay.
Take me out tonight, where there's music and there's people and the young and the light. Driving in your car, I never, never want to go home, because I haven't got one anymore. Take me out.
By 1987, the band was big enough that it had to sign with EMI in order to meet the demand for its records, and immediately everything fell apart. Johnny Marr had been working nonstop, both with the Smiths and with other bands, and he realized he was about to have a breakdown. He quit the band, and within a few months, the Smiths were no more. Well, that's not strictly true. Their cult was growing in America, and it was rampant in Britain. They'd released a lot of singles and B-sides, which hadn't shown up on albums, and their record company set about repackaging them. And they've influenced pop culture disproportionately. Smith's phrases turn up everywhere, from the Meat Is Murder meme, to Douglas Copeland's novel Girlfriend in a Coma, which is a Smith song, to a poster for a club event this past weekend, which I saw emblazoned with the words Hang the DJ. The Smiths are dead. Long live the Smiths.
Ed Ward reviewed The Smiths' complete collection, now repackaged for CD and vinyl. Coming up, TV writer David Milch, creator of the new HBO series Luck, starring Dustin Hoffman. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Our next guest, David Milch, has a history of creating groundbreaking television. The first TV script he wrote for Hill Street Blues won an Emmy. He co-created NYPD Blue and created the HBO series Deadwood, known for its colorful characters, intricate plot lines, and distinctive use of language that was antiquated and profane. Milch has won 4 primetime Emmys and a host of other awards. Milch is the creator and executive producer of the new series, Luck, on HBO. In Luck, Milch brings his gift for recreating the language, visual details, and social relations that capture a particular culture to the world of horse racing. Its central character, played by Dustin Hoffman, has emerged from prison, determined to own a championship racehorse and get even with old associates. but the episodes are richly populated with colorful characters from the track: trainers, owners, jockeys, agents, and of course, gamblers. Well, David Milch, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, this is a world that you know well. I mean, you've owned racehorses, and I know that you, as a kid, your dad owned horses, right, and was at the track?
My dad owned a few horses, and my first exposure to the races began when I was 5 years old. My dad took me out to Saratoga, which is a couple of hundred miles from where we lived in Buffalo, New York, on the other side of the state. But it was very much of a charged experience for me in that my dad's own feelings toward the racetrack were highly ambivalent and were communicated in all of their doubleness to me. The first thing he informed me was that he knew that I was a degenerate gambler, which made me quite farsighted since I was 5 years old. But that it would be impossible for me to gamble because you had to be 18 to make a bet. On the other hand, he had arranged with the waiter, Max, to run my bets for me. And with that set of mixed messages, I was off.
Was he kidding? What did he mean when he called you a degenerate gambler?
No, I think he was projecting. My dad himself was the son of the eldest of 10 children. His mother was the eldest of 10 children, and he grew up with uncles who were more or less his contemporaries. And they were my uncles, my great uncles, his uncles, pretty much all in the rackets. My dad, because he was of the next generation, despite the fact that he was a contemporary of his uncles in many cases, was not allowed to go to the racetrack. In fact, there's a story which I have no reason to disbelieve, which was that no one was supposed to fraternize with my dad in a way that would lead him astray. And he was come upon once shooting pool on the second floor of the William Street Pool Hall in Buffalo, New York. And my great uncle Chutz, who was the guy who came upon him, picked up the guy who was shooting pool with him and threw him through the window and broke his neck, which I should think imposed itself on my dad's consciousness as a sign of disapproval. In any case, his own feelings about gambling were very much mixed. And my brother, who was 2 years older than I, was raised to be a physician, as my dad was. But secretly, I think my dad nourished hopes for me in an area which had been denied him. And so he started sneaking me out to the racetrack. And with all of the complicated messagery that ensued.
I wonder if you can recall some of your earliest experiences at the track when you were a kid. What was it like?
Oh, I remember the first ticket that I ever bought. I mentioned that I had commissioned, that I dispatched Max the waiter, and he bet $2 for me on a horse called North Quest. And I remember that the horse paid $2.80. And when I returned with the ticket and I showed it to my dad, there was a mix of emotions in his features, which was, I guess, scary would be the only way to describe it. And he just turned away from me and said, "Well, go get your dough." And I suppose in a lot of ways I've been trying to figure out what that means ever since.
Well, let's talk about this HBO series, Luck. I mean, early in the series, you introduce us to some of the characters in the racing world. It has its own ecology. There are owners and trainers and jockeys and agents, and four guys who are a band of gamblers in this series. And I thought we'd listen to a clip here. This is a four guys led by Marcus, who is in a wheelchair and sucks frequently from an oxygen mask. He's played by Kevin Dunn, and this is a clip of them talking about bets they're going to place on a horse. Two of the guys, Marcus and Jerry, seem to know quite a lot about it. The other two, not so much. Let's listen.
So give me the 7, the 2, 3, 5, 6, 8, $10 try, 7 with the 2, 6 cold for 50, $200 daily double, 7, 7, that's 500.
Give me a $50 double wheel, 7 all, and the cold 7, 2, 6 try for 100, that's 800.
A Brains Housing Mimic 500 plus pick 3, us with all for $5.
That for me too, 500 mimicking Marcus and Lonnie's, your...
It's 300.
300.
Can we get to the window, please? Does it occur to you people that by mimicking my play, you reduce my prospective payout?
You know, I never thought of that.
And that's the scene from the new series Luck, created by our guest, David Milch. Tell us about these four guys. I mean, do they come from people you knew at the track?
Yeah, very much so. And they're called degenerates. And they find the rhythms and textures of their day in gambling and in associated behaviors. And most importantly, they regard themselves as outsiders to what would be the normal course of a regular guy's day.
I mean, are they at the track all day? I mean, is it?
Yeah, they're at the track all day, and they live in flea bag motels, and at night they spend their time studying the racing form.
And can you make a living doing that? To support the gambling?
You can make a living, although it's very unlikely. This is the story of four guys who, through a fortunate set of circumstances, get lucky and win a jackpot of over several million dollars.
Right. Now, you observed guys like this. Were you ever at the point where you could spend all day at a track or wanted to?
Oh, hell yes.
Yeah?
And have done for, dare I say, certainly months and, more honestly, years at a time.
Can you explain its draw? I mean, like, what happens if you go away?
It's an alternate reality. And once one enters into that world, your chemistry changes in the same way chemistry changes when you become a drug addict. And the reward systems are very different. And the paradox is that as all of this alteration is going on, you still have the opportunities and challenges of being a human being. That's the rest of the story, the how to be a human being and really the fascination of the way these people conduct their lives is what engaged my imagination.
Let's talk about another character here. Joey Rathburn, he is an agent who represents jockeys. He's played by Richard Kind. And we're going to hear a scene here where he's gotten one of his young apprentice jockeys to a chance to ride a horse for the legendary trainer Turo Escalante, who was at the track. And he screwed up by talking too much about how good the horse was. Escalante complained to the agent, Joey, that this kid was talking too much about that, how fast the horse would run, which might undermine some of Escalante's plans. So the scene we hear here is where we see the agent, Joey, encountering this young jockey. He's played by Tom Payne. Let's listen.
Hey, Joey. I met Mr. Escalante at his barn.
Oh, yeah? How'd that go?
Good. You know, he's foreign. He's a little hard to understand.
Yeah, well, you did some job.
I did?
Yeah. Pissing him off with your wise-ass chirping about how good you thought this horse was going to run today.
Well, I was just saying something to say something.
And that's what how's the weather's for.
With great trainer, I wanted to have something to say.
Suppose he's making a bet. You think he wants some big mouth riding his horse?
He betting, Mr. Escalante?
I don't know. And if you want to know, I don't want to represent you. You're a bug. You ride everything hard. And you don't chirp about what ain't your business.
And that is Richard Kind and Tom Payne in the new series Luck, created by our guest David Milch. The agent calls the jockey a bug. What does he mean?
A bug is an apprentice jockey. An apprentice jockey is a jockey who has just begun to ride. And the way that in the racing form, which is the publication which shows the entries every day, the way that when a horse is being ridden by an apprentice jockey, there is an asterisk next to the apprentice jockey's name, and that asterisk looks like a bug on the page, so that's where the nickname comes from.
Tell us about jockeys. I mean, they're a unique breed, right? They lead a tough life.
They sure are. Yeah. They're great, great athletes and ferocious competitors, and weight is a compelling and everyday fixation. If a jockey weighs too much, that's going to be reflected in his horse's performance. And so typically jockeys are always dieting and more in order to keep their weight down. They, again, addiction, speed, every kind of way of keeping weight off is used, and in addition to which, of course, they're in the sweat box all the time, and it's an awfully, awfully tough way to make a terrifically good living.
When you were a kid, did you know jockeys?
Oh, sure, sure, very well, and in fact, I used to get smuggled into the track. There was a trainer named Slim Sully who used to help me get into the track when I wasn't there with my dad, and he introduced me as a Russian exercise boy.
You needed somebody to sneak you in. Why? Because you were underage and you couldn't go without your dad?
Oh, I was, well, from the time I started sneaking out to the track outside Buffalo, I'd go hitchhike across the border into Canada where the races were. And from the time I was 7 or 8 years old, I was going to the track on my own.
Wow. Now, I also read that you would go to your basement and put on one of your dad's fedoras, light up one of his Have a Tampa cigars, and read racing forms. True?
Yeah, and they were expired racing forms. Just to add to the futility of the moment.
So what was going on there?
I was imitating my father. And the mixture of admiration and awe and fear, all of those elements cohabit, I think, in the portrayal of all of the characters, but especially the character of Dustin Hoffman in the show.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Dustin Hoffman character, who's at the center of this story.
Sure.
Name is Chester Bernstein, known as Ace, who, as the series opens, has just finished a 3-year prison term, taken a fall to protect some other guys. And this is a scene when he's sitting around with his driver and good friend, Gus, who's played by Dennis Farina. Ace has had Gus buy a racehorse, a $2 million racehorse. Gus had to hold the title to the horse because Ace, as a felon, is barred from owning a horse. Here they're back in a hotel room at the end of the day, and Gus has just returned from finally seeing the horse and speaking with the trainer, Escalante, who's going to be working with him. Let's listen.
So, how did it go?
Good. The horse moved his bowels. Took that as a positive. When he landed, he was all bound up.
But generally, how'd he look?
What do I know? He saw 4 of his legs reach the ground.
Escalante was satisfied?
Yeah, he was satisfied. He was grinning, pinching his cheek.
Those screws at Victorville, they could buy Cadillacs what I paid to let his race tapes through the mailroom. That horse is all heart. He gets by you, forget about going by him.
Roosters and birds, Ace, and goats. You take yourself for being on a farm out there.
No, I know.
I'm saying beside the horses.
Oh, beside them?
Yeah. I saw a goat out there had nuts the size of pumpkins.
I hope to Christ he was bow-legged.
He was bow-legged. How the hell did you know that?
How else would he walk around? Escalante?
Desi Arnaz?
Some trainer. I followed him 25 years, watching him climb up the ladder from nothing.
That regard, he reminds me of you.
7:45, I'm falling asleep here.
You had a full day.
And that's Dennis Farina and Dustin Hoffman reading dialogue written by our guest David Milch, the creator of the new series Luck, which is set at the racetrack. Now, Ace, in addition to being a horse owner, is a tough guy, but, I mean, it seems a guy who uses financial leverage rather than muscle in the main. I mean, is he a mob guy? Is he a businessman or a business-like mob guy?
Keep going. A business like mob guy. A business like mob guy sounds right to me. What distinguishes Bernstein from the men among whom he customarily moves is his willingness, in fact, his interest in reengaging with animals. And he doesn't himself quite understand it, but it becomes the instrument for him of a life change to the extent that he's a protagonist. The change, one hopes, occurs in the audience as well.
Now, Ace is an interesting character. In what ways is Ace like your dad?
Well, he's a very strict guy and very much given to routine. There are paradoxes in Bernstein that were shared with my dad of enormous capacity for kindness and simultaneously a tremendous distance.
Did you talk with Dustin Hoffman about your father?
Not too much. You know, it's a little bit like telling the Mississippi how to run. Dustin is as pure an athlete as I've ever encountered, and he works from the outside in certain key ways, and I didn't want to interfere with any of that process.
Well, David Milch, it's been great to have you back. Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
David Milch is creator and executive producer of the new series Luck. You can see it Sunday evenings on HBO. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
What are the resources? Yeah.